This is Impeachment, a daily podcast from WNYC. I'm Brian Lehrer. It's Tuesday, January 21st. How many days are there in 24 hours? Wait, don't I mean how many hours are there in a day? No. How many days are there in 24 hours? That apparently will be one of the first big debates in the trial of Donald Trump today. We'll explain in a minute. Another one might be, what exactly do we mean by the word exactly? Listen to Mitch McConnell here from the other day.
What was good enough for President Clinton in an impeachment trial should have been good enough for President Trump. And all we're doing here is saying we're going to get started in exactly the same way that 100 senators agreed to 20 years ago.
So when McConnell says they'll get started exactly the same way they did 20 years ago with the impeachment of Bill Clinton, well, not exactly. We'll start there with Slate senior editor Jeremy Stahl. And not to gloss over where he's coming from, Stahl's latest article is called Meet Trump's Deplorable Impeachment Team. Jeremy, great to have you. Thank you for coming on.
Hi, Brian. Thanks.
All right. How many days are there in 24 hours? I think Mitch McConnell wants the answer to be two.
So previously in Bill Clinton's trial, the days in 24 hours would have been 4 6-hour days. Now, yes, as you know, Mitch McConnell is saying something different from exactly what the impeachment rules for Bill Clinton's trial would have been in 1999, and saying now that those are 2 days and that they will be two very, very long days and that will stretch late into the night for the House managers to make the case against Donald Trump.
And so that's the answer to the second question, or it's at least implied that is not exactly like the Clinton trial opening arguments, though McConnell had said he wanted this to be exactly like that. But is this really such an advantage for Trump? I can imagine that if this pushes the arguments into prime time for a few nights, rather than just four afternoons apiece that you just said they did during Clinton, 6 hours a day, I think it was 1 to 7 p.m., there would be more people seeing the Democrats make their case this week in prime time. Or do you think I'm missing something?
Well, what I would say from having attended some of these hearings in the impeachment inquiry and having watched almost all of them going back to the Mueller probe is that when those days stretch out long, they get very long. And I think that people really only tune in for the first few hours often for these public hearings.
But I'm just saying the television audience, most of the American public, they're not tuning in from 1 to 3 p.m. because they're at work or otherwise living their lives. So maybe if they do wind up backloading some of this into 8 o'clock Eastern, 9 o'clock Eastern, 10 o'clock Eastern, everybody will get more, or more Americans will get more engaged with the arguments per se.
Yeah, that's a fair point, and I honestly couldn't say how the timing works out. These are different than, you know, the House hearings, certainly, as you know, the schedule itself will look different, and the format will be much different.
But clearly, McConnell and Trump think this is to Trump's advantage. Is it clear to you why?
I think the idea is, and it's something that they've been saying, both the Senate leadership and the president have been telegraphing either directly or indirectly for the last month, is that they want as short a trial as possible. They want a quick and what they would call a clean acquittal or dismissal. And, you know, cutting the number of days that this trial is certainly would serve that purpose.
Next controversy. I see there's a provision in McConnell's rules proposal that says not only will it take a Senate vote to admit new evidence, they'll also have to vote to even admit the existing evidence from the House hearings. Have you figured out what, if anything, that actually restricts?
No, and it's very confusing. I've tried to speak with you know, at least one source on the Hill about that, and it seems that they are even a bit confused about what that provision would actually do. But in sum and substance, it says that there would be a vote, the vote to admit the record that the House managers and the House impeachment inquiry have already collected wouldn't come until the end of the House manager's presentation. So it's very confusing as to how the House managers would present a case without their evidence having been admitted yet. But I guess the notion is they'll present their case, they'll show their evidence, and then they'll request everything they presented to be admitted at the end of the trial. And, you know, presumably the Senate Republicans will not block that much, but who knows?
Yeah. Once they get into the speeches by Adam Schiff and his cohorts on the Democratic side and Dershowitz and everybody on the Trump side, is there anything that actually stops them from saying whatever they want? Like, if Adam Schiff wants to get up and talk about new evidence, like, okay, Lev Parnas dropped all these documents, and they show that, for example, Rudy Giuliani approached the president of Ukraine and said, I'm representing President Trump as his personal attorney, not on behalf of the United States, and that kind of proves something about abuse of power. Can Adam Schiff not stand there and say that because that happened after the articles of impeachment were voted on?
So what you'll have is you have a submittal of evidence at the beginning, and what the Senate rules lay out is that the House managers will have to have submitted everything they want as evidence at the beginning. And if they stray outside the bounds of that because new evidence emerges or for whatever reason, then yes, theoretically, Trump's legal team could object if they bring in outside evidence. And then you have a ruling of the presiding officer, who is Supreme Court Chief Justice John Roberts, and or potentially a vote to overrule any ruling by Justice Roberts.
So just
there'll be plenty to talk. There'll be plenty to talk about, though, presumably.
You think?
I think these votes are going to be interesting and exciting. And, you know, Minority Leader Chuck Schumer has already promised repeatedly that he's going to force votes on some of these key contentious issues of whether or not to allow witnesses and evidence early on in this trial, as opposed to at the end of the trial, when presumably Mitch McConnell is hoping that his caucus will just vote it down. And some of those votes are certainly the way that Mitch McConnell has been projecting their fait accompli, and, you know, that they're going to be rejected. But it'll be interesting to start to see the groundwork of which Republicans senators vote which way and how they might be, how uniform the caucus is on these initial votes. And, you know, it's an impeachment trial. It's a trial. I think there's going to be plenty to discuss and plenty to be interested in, even in this first day of setting up the rules.
You know, what's one procedural question that only occurred to me last night, and I don't know if you know the answer to this, but when they get to the portion where the senators ask questions, we know they ask the questions through Chief Justice Roberts. So if they want to ask a question of Adam Schiff to challenge him or to bring him out on something, or if they want to ask a question on the other side of Kent Starr, whoever, and bring him out on something or challenge him, the question gets delivered by a senator in writing to Chief Justice Roberts. Now, what if the impeachment manager who's receiving the question ducks the question? What if they say, what do you mean Rudy Giuliani was acting on behalf of Trump as his personal lawyer, thereby helping to prove abuse of power? Why does that prove abuse of power? And Adam Schiff says something irrelevant. Will Chief Justice Roberts play moderator? Will he do like what I would do and say, well, you know, you didn't really answer the question. So the question was this. Please answer the question.
No, I'm not going to duck this question. I'm going to try not to, because I know you'll ask a very smart follow-up, but I don't think that Adam Schiff or Ken Starr or Alan Dershowitz has to be worried about Chief Justice Roberts doing the same. He's just going to be, from what I understand, basically, you know, parroting and serving as a vessel for these senators' questions. And I also think, you know, that's one of the more fascinating parts of this, because it could have a bit more weight and authority having the questions come directly from this person who is supposed to be a model of our Supreme Court and of our separate third institution that is outside of Congress and outside of the White House and supposed to be this independent branch. speaking for these senators, and it might be more awkward to duck, but there will, I don't think there's going to be any follow, there won't be any follow-up from just Chief Justice Roberts. Senators might ask follow-ups, but not the Chief Justice.
So he's going to be more game show host than Andrea Mitchell. You know, what we have here is a new car, and the question is, do you like the new car? Okay, your article on Slate calling Trump's legal team deplorable. We talked a lot yesterday about Ken Starr and Alan Dershowitz, and everybody's talking about them ad nauseum. But you also highlight Robert Ray, who, like Starr, was also a Clinton-era independent counsel. Something about him and stalking?
Yes, there was an arrest in, I guess it was 2006, and, you know, a person accused him of sending emails and visiting against her wishes after the relationship had been broken off. And that's, you know, it speaks, I guess, somewhat to just the ickiness of the whole team when you lump in also Alan Dershowitz, who was an attorney for Jeffrey Epstein, who was accused and he was convicted of a really ugly crime, but he got a sweetheart deal. And there was allegations of obviously serial sex trafficking when he died, and just combine all this milieu of kind of ugliness and stink around the team itself. One that, you know, Monica Lewinsky, who was at the center of the last impeachment scandal, you know, kind of poignantly noted, made her say, "Are you freaking kidding me?" Using a little bit more obscene language than that, though.
Monica Lewinsky weighs in on the selection of Starr to come back into the scene. And there's also Jay Sekulow, who you kind of tag, and a lot of people know him because he's already a Trump TV lawyer. He's on Fox a lot, who you kind of tag with being pro-conservative Christian and anti-Muslim in his track record of taking cases.
Yeah, that's right. He, you know, he was a leading voice in opposing, along with Rudy Giuliani, the so-called Ground Zero Mosque, which was just an Islamic center in downtown Manhattan. And at the same time, he made his bones for his entire legal career, supposedly standing up for religious liberty, but in cases, again, for evangelical and causes of the Christian right, which just notes, you know, a kind of ugly religious hypocrisy there.
And there's the White House counsel, Pat Cipollone. He succeeded Don McGahn in that role. For people who don't follow these things closely, remember McGahn, who famously resisted some of Trump's orders to him to hamper the Mueller investigation and testified about that to Mueller. That's the basis for some of the obstruction of justice charges that people wanted to bring against Trump. Don McGahn, Pat Cipollone replaced him, and let's say hasn't been one of the grown-ups in the room in the same way?
Well, it's funny because, you know, the House impeachment managers just this morning, within, I guess, the last hour and a half or so, asked, submitted a letter to Pat Cipollone asking him to either recuse himself or disclose everything he knows about the impeachment charges themselves, saying, the claim being that he was deeply involved in both elements, in both charges, obstruction of Congress and abuse of power. He was at the center of both of those incidents. And it's, you know, longstanding legal principles say you can't be a witness and a lawyer for the defendant at the same time. And that's just one of the many reasons why, you know, there are some big problems with Pat Cipollone as one of these attorneys.
This goes both ways, and I didn't know that Pat Cipollone breaking news until you just said it, but, you know, the Republicans have asked that Adam Schiff also either recuse himself or be forced to testify as a material witness on the Democrat side because allegedly or reportedly the whistleblower might have come to his staff before the whistleblower went through some of the Justice Department legal channels, and so people want Adam Schiff to testify. So neither of them going to do it.
Yeah, I would say that the reasonable argument to say that the case is stronger for Cipollone is that the events that center on this charge of abuse of power, withholding aid from Ukraine in order to enact this pressure campaign to get them to investigate a chief political rival, those incidents were reported to Pat Cipollone in real time, probably by the whistleblower sources. We know Fiona Hill and Alex Vindman and Tim Morrison, who were members of the national security team, all reported to John Eisenberg their concerns about the president's ask. And he reportedly directed those concerns to his direct superior, who was Pat Cipollone. So he was directly involved in this and is, you know, I would argue, more of a material witness.
One of the defense arguments taking center stage since Starr and Dershowitz were named is their position that even if everything in the articles is true, like abuse of power by conditioning military aid to Ukraine on their willingness to smear Joe Biden, these are not impeachable things. Here's Dershowitz on CNN.
You need a crime. Without a crime, there can be no impeachment.
Jeremy, this is interesting in part for how ahistorical it is. Did you know that people have already been impeached by the House and removed by the Senate for things other than actual crimes?
Yeah, and also, you know, in the impeachment charges against President Nixon that the Judiciary Committee voted on before he resigned, abuse of power was a charge, and obstruction of Congress was a charge. And so there is historical precedent even for charges like this against a sitting president. So and what constitutional scholars have said during the Judiciary Committee's impeachment hearing in the fall was that, you know, no, you don't need a crime for there to be a high crime. And in looking at how the founders laid out the notion of high crimes, they didn't know what the federal code and what the federal statutes and what the criminal statutes of 2020 the United States would be. So obviously they didn't mean that specifically it had to be felony USC 12B whatever in order to constitute a high crime and misdemeanor.
Right. In fact, I thought listeners who may be confused by this question being raised and not something that, you know, you spend a lot of time reading history about, might be interested to hear a few little things. One is the Wall Street Journal in October wrote this, that in addition to actual crimes, quote, Congress has made clear that it also believes violations of the public trust, even non-criminal ones, can be impeachable. The House has twice impeached judges for intoxication on the bench, resulting in their conviction or resignation. Congress has also impeached judges for favoritism, abuse of power, improper relationship with litigants, abuse of the contempt power, and arbitrary and oppressive conduct. So that from the Wall Street Journal, which, you know, on its editorial page tends to be pro-Trump on this. So isn't that interesting that early in our country's history, Jeremy, this exact controversy broke out. One party was accusing the other of an invalid impeachment because it needed to be a crime. But this guy got removed from a judgeship because he was drunk on the bench.
Yeah, that I would say is one of the weakest of their and most ahistorical of their arguments, this notion that there has to be a federal criminal offense. And that, you know, the cleaner version of the argument that was in the president's lengthy defense brief that was submitted over the weekend would just be, and even this is, it's harder, but it's a little bit easier to swallow, which is just that you don't know what the president's motives were. You can't charge him for abuse of power when his motives could have been as pure as snow, wanting an investigation of one of his chief political rivals, Joe Biden, because he wanted to get to the truth and stand up against corruption in Ukraine and against Burisma and against all these corrupt oligarchs, and that would have been a legitimate purpose. So you can't challenge him in doing that. And, you know, it strains credulity, obviously, with all the evidence that the House impeachment inquiry was able to gather, even despite the unprecedented obstruction of their efforts to get documents and witnesses. But that is at least a more believable and stronger argument, I would say, than claiming that, you know, you can't impeach him because he didn't do a crime.
Yeah, and just to put a point on it, on only crimes being impeachable, Dershowitz would also have to argue with Alexander Hamilton. Here is some Hamilton language from the Federalist Papers. In case you were wondering what I was doing before the show today, looking up things like Federalist 65 on the jurisdiction of impeachment. Quote, "The subjects of its jurisdiction are those offenses which proceed from the misconduct of public men, or in other words, from the abuse or violation of some public trust." There it is, abuse of power, abuse or violation of some public trust. "They are of a nature which may, with peculiar propriety, be denominated political, as they relate chiefly to injuries done immediately to the society itself." And that last line, Jeremy, is so strikingly what the Democrats are talking about. And again, this is not to take a partisan position that the Democrats are right and Trump should be removed from office. But in terms of what this is about as an impeachment trial, Hamilton wrote, political as they relate chiefly to injuries done immediately to the society itself. And that's exactly the question on the table here. Is Trump injuring our society by the way he abuses power as president?
Yeah, and I would say I didn't have as wild of a morning looking up Federalist paper citations as you did, but that I would just add that one of the main concerns of the Founding Fathers, and I believe was addressed in the Federalist Papers, was this notion that a foreign power might be solicited to affect and impact an election by a corrupt president, and that in itself would be impeachable. It's directly discussed there, and that is precisely what the president has been accused of.
For today, we thank Jeremy Stahl, senior editor for Slate. Jeremy, thanks so much.
Thank you, Brian. Have a great day.
Again, listeners, you can call and ask an impeachment news question. Just leave a voicemail anytime, including your name and where you're calling from, and some of you will hear your questions on the show. The number is 844-745-TALK. That's 844-745-TALK or 844-745-8255. Impeachment, a daily podcast, is excerpted from my live daily radio show, which we also invite you to listen to. It's The Brian Lehrer Show, 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time, streaming live then at WNYC.org. See you tomorrow.